So first of all, thanks very much for this invitation. It's a pleasure to be here, of course. So in this talk, I will review a work. Maybe I just need a pointer. Is it this one? Yeah.
I'll bring it.
Yeah. Doesn't look like.
I'll bring you.
Okay. Okay, at the beginning, I will not need anyone.
There's a switch on the side.
So I will talk about a work I did recently last year and also in a second paper last week about baryogenesis scenario. I did this work with in collaboration with Daniel and Teresi, who is a postdoc in Brussels. So I don't know how far you are familiar with the leptogenesis framework. Maybe I should, it would be better to introduce it for a few minutes, no? Yeah. So so to introduce leptogenesis, let me start by saying that it's, as of today, it's probably the most motivated and straightforward explanation we have for to account for the baryon asymmetry of the universe. For two main reasons. The first one is that it is a mechanism which can explain the baryon asymmetry of the universe from the very same interaction than the ones you need anyway to add to the standard model to account for the neutrino masses. So that's quite nice. And the second reason is that if you assume such neutrino mass interactions, they can induce baryogenesis through leptogenesis in a very efficient way. There is a series of numerical coincidence which makes this mechanism particularly effective. So as you probably all know, to explain the neutrino masses, there are three called the CISO models. So these are ways to induce the neutrino masses from the exchange of a heavy particle. You can have either a right-handed neutrino, a scalar triplet, fermion triplet. An important comment to do here already is that the scale of these new states is not at all fixed. So basically, if you take the neutrino mass formula for the type 1 model with right-handed neutrinos, which is the one I will consider in this talk, if you take Yukawa of order 1, you get neutrino masses of order 0.1 TeV, what you want for right-handed neutrino mass as large as 10 to the 14, 15 GeV. But you could also take Yukawa couplings like the electron one, and then you are at TV scale, but you could go even lower. So this scale is totally free. Now, from this type 1 CISO model here, inducing the Weinberg operator in this way, so neutrino masses, there are basically three main ingredients, basic ingredients for leptogenesis. The first one is the so very well-known CPR symmetry. So typically, the average delta L produced per decay. So short after the Big Bang, the right-handed neutrinos, they will disappear from the universe thermal bath at a temperature of order their mass by decaying from the Yukawa interactions, the one at the origin of the neutrino masses. So by decaying, they can either produce lepton or anti-leptons because lepton number is broken by the Majorana masses. And so if they don't produce leptons and anti-leptons in equal number, you will produce a lepton asymmetry. This lepton asymmetry at lowest order is generated at one loop level. So you have a vertex diagram, a self-energy diagram. They involve the three of them, three Yukawa couplings. and two right-handed neutrinos, the decaying one and the virtual one here. So you can compute the CPS symmetry. It's a function of the Yukawa couplings. You have four of them because it's interference of the one loop with the tree level in a CP violating combination. And you have a function which depends on those masses of the right-handed neutrinos. Now, once you have the CPS symmetry, the naive expectation at first sight you could say, you could make is that you could have is that the final lepton asymmetry you will produce in such a way is simply so divided by the entropy density will be just the number of right-handed neutrinos you had before they decay at the temperature above their mass times the average delta L they produce per decay divided by the entropy density. So it's as simple as that. Now, however, this naive expectation is not always true. In fact, in general, you have an extra suppression factor here, which is called the efficiency. So in fact, the efficiency is one. So you recover the formula I put just before. If everything was out of equilibrium in the when the asymmetry was produced. If it's not the case, then if the N decays partly in thermal equilibrium or if there is washout of the L asymmetry, this means that if you form a lepton asymmetry, if the decays are very fast, the inverse decays will be also very fast. So if you have more leptons than antileptons, the probability for the leptons to inverse decay will be larger than the probability for the antileptons to inverse decay. So you will put back the asymmetry to zero. This is the washout effect. This is a statistical effect in the thermal bath. So you have to account for this third Sakharov condition. You need to be basically out of equilibrium if you don't want too much suppression. And this efficiency, you can calculate it from the usual Boltzmann equations, which are differential equations which give you the evolution of the number of right-handed neutrinos, the lepton asymmetry as a function of temperature of Z. Z is the mass of right-handed neutrinos over T. Okay. So you have the decay term and you have also scattering processes which can wash out the asymmetry. So the main condition to avoid this efficiency suppression is the out of equilibrium condition for the decay. So the total decay width has to be smaller than the Hubble rate. Okay, I guess you all know that. So once you have the lepton asymmetry from this formula, from the Boltzmann equation, then the third ingredient consists in the fact that if you have a L asymmetry produced in the thermal bath, then automatically a baryon asymmetry will be also produced from the effect of the Sphaleron effects, so the non-perturbative standard model effects, which are very suppressed at zero temperature, but in the thermal bath, at temperature above 130-140 GeV, they are in thermal equilibrium, and since they break B plus L but conserve B minus L, typically they will convert half of the lepton asymmetry into a baryon asymmetry, in such a way that you get a baryon asymmetry, which is which you can compare with the observed values, and in such a way that you can explain this baryon asymmetry. So these are the three basic ingredients. Now, from these basic ingredients, let me review very quickly first the usual scenario, which is a high scale scenario. So you consider the right-handed neutrino masses to be much above the electroweak scale. At such high scales, in fact, leptogenesis is really efficient for mainly for two reasons, kind of numerical coincidences. The first one is that if you are with right-handed neutrinos very heavy, and if you consider a hierarchical spectrum of right-handed neutrinos, a bit like quarks and leptons in the standard model, then you can show that the CP asymmetry is bounded from above by an expression which goes like the atmospheric splitting of a neutrino mass, which is fixed, times the mass of the right-handed neutrino, which decays and produces the asymmetry, And so if you impose to the CPS symmetry to be large enough to give you enough baryonic symmetry, you will get a lower bound on the mass of the decaying right-handed neutrino, which is of order 10 to the AGV. If you think about that, it's quite nice because this scale is determined by the amount of baryonic symmetry you need to produce. And it turns out that it gives you a scale, and above this scale, there is plenty of room to accommodate the neutrino mass constraints. As I said, you can go up to 10 to the 15 GeV to have the right neutrino masses, so that you have plenty of room to have a successful leptogenesis. No, probably more impressive is the second coincidence. As I said, if you don't want to have too much suppression from the fact that you would be too much in thermal equilibrium, you need gamma over H to be smaller than 1, but you can show that in full generality since gamma, the decay width of the right-handed neutrino to lepton and X doublet is proportional to 2 UKawas. You can show that this ratio, in fact, has the same parametric dependence as the neutrino masses, but not in the same combination. But I mean, it involves 2 power of UKawa couplings over 1 right-handed neutrino masses. So as a result, you can show that, in fact, this bound, which has to be smaller to have no efficiency suppression, is in full generality always larger than the neutrino mass, the mass of the smallest mass of the 3 neutrinos, I mean mu min, over a scale which is 10 to the minus 3 EV. So if you think about that, it's quite nice because 10 to the minus 3 EV is typically around the neutrino mass scale. So I mean, this scale 10 to the minus 3 EV has nothing to do with the neutrino mass. It's a combination of the electroweak scale and the Planck mass coming from the Hubble rate. And it gives you 10 to the minus 3 EV, which is, and you know that the neutrino mass is this new mu min can be between 0 and typically 0.2 EV or so. So you will never get this ratio very big. So you will never get a lot of washout, and that's why leptogenesis really works well. Okay. For example, if the neutrino masses were around the KV scale, the right-handed neutrinos would be always in very deep thermal equilibrium, so you would have suppressed suppression. You would never get the amount of baryonic symmetry you need. So that's basically all what I wanted to say about this high-scale, well-known leptogenesis scenario. Of course, based on these 3 ingredients, of course, if you want to compute that in detail, you need to incorporate a lot of extra effects like the flavor effects. I will not give any details here, but basically, so far, we were just counting the number of leptons produced through inverse decay and leptons which disappear from the thermal bath by decaying, without taking care about their flavor, if they were of the muon, of the electron muon or tau type. But you can show that in various temperature regime, if you want to be precise, you cannot do that. You have to compute the evolution of the electron lepton number asymmetry, the number of electrons minus the number of positrons, and same for nu in nu e bar, separately from the mu 1, from the tau 1. So you have 3 Boltzmann equations, and they interplay, and they don't give you the same result as just 1 naive Boltzmann equation with the number of leptons. So this I will not explain. I will just say that you always, for CP violation, you always need 2. Yeah. So when you consider 3 Boltzmann equations for electron mu and tau, you have new effects. One effect which will be important also for the scenario I will consider later is the fact that in this case, on top of this asymmetry where you see that the lepton here and the lepton here have opposite direction, so where you see that there is really explicit lepton number violation, okay? So you go from L equal to minus one to L equal to one state. If you invoke flavor, you have also another diagram which where it's the same diagram but with the arrows in the same direction. So this doesn't break lepton, total lepton number, because you see that if you assign lepton number one to the right-handed neutrinos, you go to one, to one, to one, to one. But still it can generate flavor asymmetries. For example, it can give you a lepton number asymmetry only for the electron and for the muon and the tau. But the sum of them will have to be zero, because you know that you don't break the total lepton number. So with flavor, you have new diagrams, and they will be kind of relevant later. So that's the only thing I wanted to say about flavor. Now let's go to...
So yeah. You work out this flavor asymmetry
with the variance? Yeah, I will come with a scenario where this happens explicitly, but it will not be this one, it will be at low scale, but this is similar. Basically, you can show that... You will see. I will discuss an example. Okay, so let's go to low-scale leptogenesis. When we say low-scale leptogenesis, in general, it means that the right-handed neutrinos are around TV, for example, a bit above the electroweak scale. There, in fact, the point is that as we have seen, if you have hierarchical right-handed neutrinos, to have successful leptogenesis, you need to be above 10 to the 8 GeV. However, it would be kind of nice to go lower for at least three reasons. The first one is purely practical. If they are above 10 to the 8 GeV, we will never produce them. So it would be nice to see if we could go to lower scale to see if we can produce them. The second one is that if you go to the supersymmetric framework, only in this case, leptogenesis works exactly in the same way. You just factor for the unity differences. But in this case, you are in a kind of tension with the gravity upper bound on the heating temperature, which typically tells you that if you don't want to overpopulate the universe with gravity, no, you need a temperature below 10 to the 8 GeVs. Of course, there are ways out, but let's say in the simplest case. So you see there is a tension between these two bounds. And the third... Yeah, of course. This is what I will do. Yeah. So the third issue is a kind of naturalness problem you can like or not like, but typically if you take the self-energy of the X mass, of the X boson with two Yukawa couplings, so the boson goes to a right-handed neutrino and a lepton, then goes back to X boson, so from the Yukawa couplings of the CISO interaction, you get a correction which is proportional to mu times mn at the third power. And if you impose then to delta m square h, to be this radiative correction to the X boson mass to be below TV, then you need the right-handed neutrino mass to be below 10 to the 7 GeV, so there is a kind of tension too, but of course you can say that you don't care about that, but let's say that it's kind of relevant because here it's not, you know what is the physical cutoff of your self-energy, it's the right-handed neutrino mass.
Well, it's not too bad, it's not too far from 4.7.
Yeah. Okay, but this is TV already, huh? So you've already won a kind of little hierarchy, but I don't care really, it's just, okay. So, if you want to go to, for example, if you want to lift up this naturalness problem, you have three possibilities. Either you go to frameworks where you regularize this self-energy, like supersymmetry, but then you have the gravity in your problem. Will not do that, or you reduce the effective electroweak VEF entering in neutrino masses. This I will not explain, but in this 10 to the 8 GeV, there is a power of the electroweak scale. So if you have, for example, two X doublets, and if the vacuum expectation value contributing to the neutrino mass is below 246 GeV, then you reduce this one, but you will gain some factor. But I will not discuss that too much. I will discuss more the third option, which is to give up which consists in giving up the assumption that the right-handed neutrinos have a hierarchical spectrum, but a quasi-degenerate spectrum. In this case, what happens is that from the self-energy diagram, you see directly that the propagator of the virtual right-handed neutrino will, both masses are approximately equal. You will have a resonant effect. As a result, you get a CP asymmetry, which with this resonance coming from the bright vigneur there of the propagator. And as a result, what you can see is that the CP asymmetry is not bounded anymore by an expression proportional to mu or mn1, but it's just bounded by one unity, like any CP asymmetry. So you can get much larger CP asymmetries. And basically, the only lower cutoff is the Sphaleron decoupling scale and the mass of the Higgs boson. So because you still need to produce the asymmetry above the Sphaleron decoupling temperature, if you want the lepton asymmetry to be converted to baryon asymmetry. But so, for example, TV scale is perfectly possible. Of course, this is quite nice because you are still only in the pure CISO Lagrangian, but you do one more assumption. You have to assume a symmetry to explain that these two right-handed neutrinos would have similar masses. But why not? I mean, okay, so that's a possibility, which I will not discuss much either. There is an old literature about the possibilities to test such frameworks, which is not so easy, but at least you can, in this case, falsify leptogenesis. But I will not discuss that. What I would like to discuss is a framework where you go even to lower masses. So the right-handed neutrino masses would be of order GeV, 10 GeV, a fraction of GeV, smaller than the electroweak scale. So here I would like to discuss a framework we propose with Daniele Teresi. So first of all, before explaining this framework, let me say that if you go to such low masses for the right-handed neutrinos, then you enter a totally different regime for several reasons. So you are in a regime where still you need to produce the asymmetry above the Sphaleron decoupling temperature to have conversion to a baryon asymmetry. But in this case, this Sphaleron decoupling temperature, which is 135 GeV, is much larger than the right-handed neutrino masses. So you need scenarios where you don't produce anymore the asymmetry at a temperature of order de masse, but at a temperature much larger. Okay? And this has several consequences. One consequence is that since you produce the asymmetry above the Sphaleron temperature, which is above all masses here, clearly the thermal effects will be important. So typically, it means you have to add thermal corrections to the masses and also to the CP asymmetry. And the thermal correction goes like T square, and if T is much bigger than Mn, this thermal contribution to the mass can easily dominate the mass. So if you want to do any calculation, you have to incorporate those thermal effects. And related to that, another difference, consequence, is that if you go very low in mass at some point, with or without thermal correction, the usual decay of a right-handed neutrino going to doublet of lepton and Higgs doublet will be kinematically forbidden. But in this case, another channel opens up, which is the inverse process where the Higgs boson doublet decays to right-handed neutrinos and a lepton doublet. So this is shown here. So So this plot shows you for various values of the zero temperature right-handed neutrino mass, the temperature where both decays are possible. So if you have a large right-handed neutrino mass, N2LH is possible, but if you have a small one, then you will have H2NL, but only for certain temperature, because kinematically you have the thermal correction to the mass ici. Okay. So the question for the following is: what are the possibilities to induce the leptogenesis, baryogenesis, from X decay to a right-handed neutrino and a lepton doublet decay? So typically within these regions where temperature region where this decay is kinematically allowed.
Before you proceed, I just wanted to understand. There was a whole bunch of literature.
Yeah,
it was called Rumbakov.
Yeah, I come to that. But at the moment, I don't talk about that because I do it with totally different formalism, and then I will go to the formalism of them to compare.
But it's the same physics behind the.
It's not the same contribution. Because we consider a violate total lepton number violating decay, and ARS they were always saying it's totally negligible, and so we saw that it's not negligible from a way which is quite different from their way, their formalism. But then in the new paper last week we consider our scenario within the density matrix formalism they consider. And then we could see that there are many similarities, but it's not the same contribution. Yeah. This I will explain. Okay. So, but before coming to that, if you want to induce lepton asymmetry from this decay, at very first sight, you would say it's not possible for two reasons, at least. The first one has to do with the out of equilibrium decay, the third Sakharov condition. There is a difference between this decay and to LH and this decay, which is that for L to N to LH, the decaying particle will not be in thermal equilibrium. The right-handed neutrino will not be in thermal equilibrium. It is in this way that you can induce an asymmetry. Whereas for the X decay, the X doublet is always in deep thermal equilibrium. So the decaying particle is not in thermal equilibrium. And so you could wonder if you can do it. In fact, you can see right away that yes, this is not a problem, because the third Sakharov condition doesn't tell you that it is the decaying particle which should be out of equilibrium. If in the final state the right-handed neutrino is not in thermal equilibrium, you will also satisfy the Sakharov condition, so it's kind of trivial condition. The only thing is that now the decay will give you in the Boltzmann equation the equilibrium distribution and the inverse decay the real right-handed neutrino number density. So it's just the opposite from the usual case. There is a sign difference, but this is not a problem. More serious is the second issue. We know that to have lepton asymmetry, we need CP violation, and to have CP violation, we need an absorptive part. I mean, we need to have the imaginary part of a loop diagram. In the X to NL decay, the only loop diagram you could which could give you that is a diagram where you put a self-energy on the right-handed neutrino. But if you look at that, what you see is that in order to have an absorptive part here, you need the mass of H plus the mass of L to be bigger than the mass of N. But this is clearly not the case, because you need, for this decay to proceed, you need the mass of H to be bigger than the mass of L plus the mass of N. So you have no absorptive part, but in fact, this is not a real problem either, because you have no absorptive part only at zero temperature. But if now you compute this self-energy diagram with finite temperature corrections, so we say we compute the thermal cut of this diagram, then we can show that there is a contribution where the either the H or the L comes from the thermal bath. So basically you cut this diagram, but by cutting it in thermal bath, you allow, for example, the lepton doublet here to come from the thermal bath and then to go out from here. So you really cut this. And if you do that, then it is again kinematically allowed because the L, it's not closed the diagram anymore. It comes from the thermal bath, okay? So in such a way, you get an absorptive part. So what you have to do is to calculate the absorptive part. And here I will not give too many details. It has been done already in the literature, the thermal cut of right-handed neutrinos for application in other scenarios. So, but just to give you an idea, the point is that you have to compute the thermal self-energy, which has contribution where you have a double integral over the particle in the loop. With propagators of the lepton and the X doublet. So it looks like really like the usual self-energy, except that the propagators you consider here are thermal propagators. So they are called Weinmann propagators. And these propagators, they have, for example, the X1 as... these propagators, they take into account the fact that some of the particles, they can come from the thermal bath.
So is this consistent when you, I don't know, when you take only thermal masses into account, but not other thermal corrections? Thermal masses is the summation, yeah. Right?
Yeah, but here it's more than the thermal mass. I mean, if you take just the thermal masses in this diagram, it will remain kinematically forbidden. Here I am, we are considering finite temperature effect to the self-energy. So it's not only about the mass, it's also about the fact that some of the particles can come from the thermal bath. So basically it's consistent, yeah. And we will compare after with the density matrix formalism and we'll see that we get basically the same result. But okay, so typically the self-energy of the lepton here can give you a contribution proportional to the Fermi-Dirac momentum distribution of the L bar. And then this thermal propagator of the X doublet will give you a 1 plus Bose-Einstein distribution. So typically, you interpret that as if you cut the diagram in such a way that really you have a L bar coming from the thermal bath, with a one, so it's proportional to FL bar, then a X, and then a L bar goes back to the thermal bath. So when you compute such kind of integrals, you get a thermal width when you cut, which is like the usual thermal width at zero temperature times some factor. And the point is that here the factor will be proportional to the number of L of L bar, like here. And then you have another diagram where you cut the X propagator, but not the L, I mean in thermal way. So you have also FH. And we get only FL and FH. We don't get any one because that if you don't have a particle coming from the thermal bath, as we saw, it must be zero. So it's really a purely thermal effect where one of the particles in the thermal cut comes from the thermal bath. So you compute that, you have the thermal self-energy, you put it back in this diagram, you compute the CP asymmetry in the usual way, and you get just the same CP asymmetry, resonant leptogenesis CP asymmetry, but with the thermal cut, no, depending on the temperature, and also the mass differences between the right-handed neutrinos will be also thermal. There are thermal corrections there. So you have this expression. You compute the Boltzmann equation for x decay and inverse x decay. You integrate.
Could you asked.
Yeah.
So the number, the power of the car company is the same, right? And
then yeah. So you have three Yukawa couplings here, and then you take the interference with the three level, it gives you four. So basically, you have two Yukawa couplings in the self energy, yes. But then after we will see that in some cases, like ARS, you will get the power will be the sixth power, but okay, I will come to that. But in this case, you have a contribution proportional to the fourth power of the Yukawa couplings with a CP violating combination of the Yukawa couplings, which is the usual total lepton number violating one. I mean, it's the one where you have a Majorana mass insertion. So you have N, you reverse the arrow of the N here if you want. And that's why you have YN1 square, it goes twice in the same direction. And that's why it breaks total lepton number, and you have a CP violating component like that. Okay, so you integrate this kind of this CP asymmetry in the Boltzmann equation. You integrate the Boltzmann equation, and here are the results. I mean, it's quite simple scenario, but. So you can integrate the Boltzmann equation, and here are the results. First, for the case where you would assume that the right-handed neutrino before they produce the CP the lepton asymmetry, you assume that they are already in thermal equilibrium. So for example, if you have a left-right model, for example, then you have a W-right around, which has large gauge interaction with the right-handed neutrinos. They thermalize the right-handed neutrinos, and then you start from a situation where it's thermalized. Or you assume very large Yukawa coupling, and it's also thermalized by the Yukawa couplings. So in this case, here is the contour plot of the CP asymmetry we need for successful baryogenesis through leptogenesis. As a function of the mass of the right-handed neutrino and the so-called M-tilde parameter, which is typically the size of the Yukawa coupling normalized in the neutrino mass way. So what you see is that you can have you need CP asymmetry of order 10 to the minus 7, 5, 6, 2, 0, and then if you take the maximum CP asymmetry, you get this line with zero, okay? So you can get successful leptogenesis if you can manage to get this amount of CP asymmetry, which means basically that you can do it easily, but you need an amount of quasi-degeneracy between the masses. So that's the assumption you have always to do. Okay, so it works very well, but you need one right-handed neutrino mass to be close to another one, so kind of CP symmetry. Now, you can show that if you impose the neutrino mass constraints, in fact, you can never get CP symmetry of order 1. For example, here, you need always to be above the blue line. So what is below the blue line is not relevant. You can, what is above is successful. Okay. So what you see is that you get a bound that the right-handed neutrino mass has to be above 2.2 GeV. And you can compare that with the bound you would get from N to LH decay if you don't consider the X decay, which would be 50 GeV, for example, okay, in this case. So these are the results with the right-handed neutrinos, which starts already in a thermalized situation. Now you can go to the other case where you start with right-handed neutrinos which have not thermalized. And there we can make two comments. First of all, if there is no W right, for example, around with big gauge interaction to thermalize everything, then in general, unless you have very large Yukawa couplings, much larger than the one you expect from neutrino masses, then you never the right-handed neutrinos they never thermalize. So if no extra interaction thermalizing N, no thermalization is much more natural than in ordinary leptogenesis. What I mean is that because you need to produce the asymmetry at a temperature above the Sphaleron decoupling temperature, which is much bigger than the right-handed neutrino mass, the thermalization condition, the CP asymmetry is produced at temperature much larger than Mn. And so the thermalization condition is a thermalization condition at temperature much bigger than Mn. And you can show that to have thermalization at temperature much bigger than Mn, you need much larger Yukawa couplings than in ordinary leptogenesis, where the thermalization condition is a condition at temperature of order Mn where you produce the asymmetry. So this is easy because just if you are at higher temperature, the Hubble rate is larger by T square. So you need larger Yukawa coupling. So I mean, for ordinary leptogenesis, as soon as the M tilde, which is like Yukawa square, is bigger than 10 to the minus 3 EV, you thermalize. The Yukawa will thermalize the right-handed neutrinos. Here, since you need to have thermalization is for a temperature much bigger, you will have thermalization only for much larger Yukawa coupling. So in general, you have no thermalization, okay? And if you have no thermalization, the point is that from this decay, you can show that when you start with a situation where you have no right-handed neutrinos, in fact, you boost by several orders of magnitude the asymmetry production. Unlike for the usual leptogenesis case, so without giving too many details, it is due to the fact that the H, anyway, is there the X the doublet components? They are there anyway in the thermal bath because these are thermalized particles. So the decay will always occur. Whereas for the ordinary leptogenesis mechanism, if you start with no right-handed neutrino, but you will not produce anything, you need first to produce the right-handed neutrinos to have a CP asymmetry because you need to produce the particle which will decay. Here, the particle which will decay is anyway there. So the decay is anyway there. And so since the production is proportional always to nn equilibrium minus nn, the x decay will give you a large nn equilibrium, and the inverse decay will give, at the beginning, since you have no n, will give you nothing. So you boost the asymmetry. And that's why when you look at the results, you open a lot the parameter space. And you can go to much lower values of the right-handed neutrinos with, and you don't need so big CP asymmetry. So for example, if you have a splitting of order 10 to minus 5, you can have successful leptogenesis. But you will always need some kind of splitting, otherwise you will never get it. But that's always the case at low scale. So you can have successful leptogenesis even with right-handed neutrinos as low as with masses as low as 20 MeV. But you have to take care about BBN because if you are as low, the decay will occur during BBN. So basically, you need to be above this line. So you cannot go as low as that typically, unless maybe you play, but it's not so clear. So, and another interesting property is that you can show that the production of the asymmetry will be just before the Sphaleron cut. So typically between TV and the Sphaleron decoupling temperature. So this mechanism relies fully on electroweak scale physics. You don't care about what is happening before, which is kind of interesting and kind of unique, I think. So, okay, now another interesting property is that you are in a range of right-handed neutrino masses where you could, in principle, produce the right-handed neutrinos explicitly in experiment like SHIP, so part of the parameter space, but not all of it. You can test it. It's kind of unique. Well, in the Rubakov scenario, you can also do that, yeah. So this is all I wanted to say. Now about the mechanism. Now coming back to your question. In fact, there are still two questions we could ask, important question. The first one is that, as you said yourself, if you have right-handed neutrino masses around GV, Then the scenario I was considering is not the only one. There is another one which is there around for many years. Baryogenesis mechanism with only CISO interaction, nothing else like in the scenario I was considering. So, and what you see, it is the well-known scenario from where you get baryogenesis from right-handed neutrino oscillation, which is often called ARS. Akhmedov-Rubakov-Smirnov mechanism. Even if in the original version, in fact, these mechanisms didn't work, people like Azaka-Shaposhnikov, after they refine it and they show that it works. So clearly an important question would be to compare our contribution with the ARS-1. So basically, is there an overlap between both contributions? Which one is dominant? So it's a question to ask. The other question is that to compute the evolution of asymmetries, what we did so far is to use a usual decay formalism. You count the number of leptons in a lepton disappearing with the decays or appearing with the inverse decays. But there is also another formalism which is very well known to describe the system of right-handed neutrinos at such scales, especially when you have thermal effects, is the density matrix formalism. So clearly it would be interesting to compare the results in the decay formalism we considered with the one we would get for the same scenario in the density matrix formalism, okay? That would be also interesting because this ARS mechanism has been considered in density matrix formalism. So if we compute our contribution in this formalism, we will be able to compare both contribution within the same formalism, the density matrix one. So this is what these two questions, this is what I will, these are the questions I will consider for the time remaining. So I will have no time to really explain the in full length how you compute the baryon asymmetry produced within the density matrix formalism. But okay, the density matrix formalism is a well-known quantum mechanics formalism generalized to quantum field theory, where basically the system of right-handed neutrinos is described by the density matrix. So you have a density matrix for the right-handed neutrinos, you have a density matrix for the anti-right-handed neutrinos. So it's a matrix, the diagonal elements give you the number density of the n alpha state, n1, n2, n3. And off-diagonal components typically give you the coherence between right-handed neutrinos. So if you have oscillations between right-handed neutrinos, clearly, it has to do with the of diagonal elements. So in this formalism, the evolution of the density matrix is given by a Schrödinger equation, typically. I mean, basically. But if you develop this equation to second order in the interaction Hamiltonian, so the interaction Hamiltonian is the usual CISO-Yukawa interaction, with a change of notation. Now the Yukawa couplings, they will be called H because apparently between both papers we changed that. So so I will not explain that too much, but the bottom line is that you have to compute these commutators. And at second order in the interaction Hamiltonian, what you will have is that out of these two interaction Hamiltonian, you will get one creation operator and one destruction operator for each particle. So whenever you have a Dagger A, you get the counting operator, which is nothing but the number, the density matrix. And whenever you have A Dagger, you will have a true anti-commutation relation, a 1 minus n. So typically, when you can write down this equation with two parts, one part which is proportional to nn. So this is with a rate which is called gamma bigger. This is the absorption rate because the right-handed neutrino here is disappearing because the rate, you multiply the rate by the number of n. So basically it means one n is disappearing. This is the inverse decay. And then you have a term in 1 minus nn, where you have no nn in the, it's not proportional to nn, so it's a decay. Okay, there is no n in the initial state. So what you have to compute are those rates coming from the commutators. So the point is that if you keep only transition where there is no mass insertion, okay, for example, here there were Majorana mass insertion, so it was breaking total lepton number. But if you say we don't want to include any contribution proportional to this Majorana mass insertion because they are proportional to Mn square, and Mn square is small, it's GV, as compared to the temperature, which is much bigger, then you have only a certain contribution, and this is what has been done in ARS. So they were not taking any diagram with mass insertion. And so you get some fermionic trace of U plus U. Well, I forgot to say that the plus is the right-handed neutrino and the minus is the anti-right-handed neutrino. So you get some fermionic trace with a kind of self-energy, which is basically the same as in the Kaidanov beam formalism we were considering before. But it's the same, but it doesn't intervene at the same place. But okay, it's not for the self. It's not really the self-energy of the right-handed neutrino you are computing here at the first place, but it's proportional to the same function. So again, you have this Whitemind propagator, which are thermal propagators, giving you thermal distribution from particles coming from the thermal bath. So for example, if you take this nn gamma bigger term, you will have some Whitemind propagator and it will give you a nl bar, telling you that there is a nl bar in the initial state, and a nn telling you that there is a n in the initial state. So it's an inverse decay, for example. So in this way, you get back all processes, decays, inverse decays. But at this point, you still don't see any CP asymmetry. This comes much later. So you can compute those rates, gamma bigger and gamma smaller. Sorry. And if you do that, you get this evolution equation for the matrix, the density matrix. But what I did here to get this is to split the number of lepton as the equilibrium number plus the lepton asymmetry over 2 for the flavor L. And NL bar is the same with a minus. And so I take all terms with the equilibrium distribution on one side. These are those terms. It's a bit technical, but just to give you an idea. These are the source terms where which give you the CP asymmetry. And then there is a term proportional to delta NL. And that's the washout term, because the washout term is a term which tells you that if there is a lepton asymmetry, then statistically, if you have more leptons than antileptons, you will have more reaction with leptons than with antileptons, and the asymmetry will be put to zero back. Okay? So this is the washout proportional to delta NL. And each one has a characteristic rate, which is an integral, a thermal integral, with two Yukawa couplings. And if you compute these integrals, it's always proportional to a factor, which is the rate, numerical rate, which is of order 10 to minus 4, typically, times T4, because you have only the temperature as a scale. Okay? So that's for the production rate, and then you have two washout rates, where you have also T4 with some coefficients. So you do that for the right-handed neutrinos. You do that for the anti-right-handed neutrinos. It's a similar equation with some difference. Then you do that for the lepton asymmetry. You get this equation. And if you don't consider too large Yukawa couplings, it is called the weak washout regime. You have only a bit of washout, but not too much. Then you can solve this equation analytically. And order by order in expansion in the number of Yukawa couplings. So at first non-vanishing order, the contribution at H4, that we know that CP violation anyway need at least 4 Yukawa coupling. And thus you can have an analytical solution we derived. And it's proportional to 4 Yukawa couplings, some integral of an oscillating function with an argument which is the splitting, so it's really an oscillating pattern, times an important factor, which is the CP violating combination of the Yukawa couplings. And what you see is that the CP violating combination of the Yukawa couplings you get has no Majorana mass insertion. So typically it corresponds to this diagram where you don't change the direction of the arrow of the leptons. I agree that it's getting a bit complicated, but it would take a lot of time to explain it really in details, but at least for you to have an idea, the CP violating combination is the one, okay, I can go back. If I find it back, it's this one. So you don't change the lepton number arrow direction. So it doesn't break total lepton number, but it breaks it individually for each flavor. Okay, so this is the combination you get there. If I find it back. So it's called the lepton number conserving combination because you have no contribution, because you have no Majorana mass insertion. You have this combination, and the bottom and the bottom line is that in this way you induce individual asymmetries for each lepton flavor, but the sum of them, the sum of this, when you sum over the electron muon tos this contribution, since it doesn't break total lepton number, you will get zero. So you will not get any lepton asymmetry at this order. So that's the important property that was not explained in the original ARS paper. So there is nothing at H4, but then you have to go one order further in the H-square expansion. So you are at order H to the 6, and there you get an effect. With some rates, the prefactor of the rate, some the Planck mass, the mass splitting, the Yukawa couplings, this CP violating combination, which do not break total lepton number. So how comes you get at this level baryogenesis? The point is that if that's really the bottom line for the ARS mechanism, if there is no mass insertion, so you never break total lepton number. I mean, you can assign lepton number 1 to the right-handed neutrinos, lepton number minus 1 to the anti-right-handed neutrinos. Then one right-handed neutrino goes to a lepton, and this total lepton number is never violated. Okay. So that's why we call it the lepton number conserving contribution. However, still you can get baryogenesis, because even if at H to the 4 order, as we just saw, the lepton number asymmetries for electron muon and tau they cancel altogether, you will get at order H to the 6 an effect, because at order H to the 6 you can show that you will get the washout term coming into the game. And the point is that if, for example, you have a Yukawa coupling much larger for the electron than for the muon, Then the lepton asymmetry for the muons you will have produced at order h to the 4 will be strongly washed out because the inverse decay decays are very fast for the muon. But for the electron, will not be so much washed out. Okay. So in this way, clearly, these two, they will not compensate each other. And so the sum of the electron and muon lepton asymmetry will not go to zero. But still, the total lepton number will be conserved. So this will be compensated for the total lepton number by the asymmetry between the n and the n bar, which also has lepton number. So I'm a bit fast, but basically the bottom line is that you produce opposite lepton number asymmetries for electron and muon, but they are not washed out, statistically put to zero from inverse decay in the same way. And so you get a net lepton asymmetry for the lepton of the standard model, but still with total lepton number conserved, so it's compensated by an asymmetry for the right-handed neutrinos. And the point is that if you get to such a situation, then the lepton asymmetry of the standard model lepton will be converted to baryon asymmetry by the sphalerons. But the right-handed neutrino asymmetry, which compensates it, since you have singlets, it's not sensitive to the sphalerons, and you will not get... And it will not be converted to baryon asymmetry. So as a result, you get baryon asymmetry. So this is the ARS mechanism. Now, this is basically the way ARS works. Now, what about our contribution in this framework? Clearly, our contribution is not the same contribution as the ARS one, because it's based on Majorana mass insertion. So there is total lepton number violation from the start. It's a order h to the 4, so it has nothing to do with the order h to the 6 contribution of ARS. However, the question then is where to find this contribution in density matrix formalism. Okay. In fact, you can find this contribution in density matrix formalism, but it has always been neglected before. Because what you have to do is to compute the commutators keeping all contribution proportional to mn squared. There is a mass insertion. So typically in this bigger and smaller rate, now you have other contribution where you have the antiparticles instead of the particles. So you have n to l bar transition, which breaks lepton number, whereas in ARS you have only n to l transition. So if you compute those contributions, what you see is that you get more complicated equations for n, for n bar, and for the lepton asymmetry. So basically, wherever you add a lepton conserving ARS contribution, you have another rate, which is lepton number violating. And the point is that those rates are now proportional to mn squared t squared, not to t4, because you have mass insertion to break lepton number. Okay. And before, people said, okay, we even don't compute those contributions because they are proportional to this little mn squared. And people were convinced it was negligible. But from what we did with a totally different formalism, we saw it's not negligible. We were even not thinking about ARS. But now that we are doing that in the matrix density formalism, these are the total equations. In fact, they've been considered in a paper by not exactly the same with some more approximation by Shaposhnikov. But he just wrote them down and said it's negligible. But from what we have seen, it doesn't look negligible. So what we did is to integrate those equations. We get this baryon lepton asymmetry for this lepton violating contribution. And the whole point is that it is proportional to the CP asymmetry, which breaks total lepton number. So where you have Majorana mass insertions, and the sum of them, it's not zero anymore because it breaks total lepton number. So that's why you have a non-vanishing contribution at h to the 4, unlike the ARS, which is h to the 6. And we have to remember that at GeV, the Yukawa couplings, they are very small, so it makes a big difference.
But yeah. You can adjust the value of H, right, by choosing different screws.
Well, if you fix the mass of the right-handed neutrinos, the degenerate ones, if you don't want to invoke any cancellation between the Yukawa couplings, they are fixed to some value.
Sure.
You know, you can invoke cancellations, I agree. Because in the CISO, you have YYT transposed. And
we can have inverse CISO.
Yeah, inverse CISO, for example, is you can do that. And we also account for that. Yeah. So one difference between both contributions is that the ERS1 is suppressed by 2 power of Yukawa couplings more. Another difference is that here you have 2 rates. So this coefficient of order 10 to the minus 4, whereas in ARS, you have 3 rates because it's h to the 6. So it is in favor of the contribution we consider. But on the other hand, you have this MN square suppression and a different dependence in the splitting and the Planck mass. So altogether, if you put that together, what you see is that all the factors more or less compensate each other with dominance of one or the other contribution depending on the parameters. So before people said, well, this MN square anyway will kill everything, but that's not true because you gain here, you lose here, that's true, but all together, nobody never calculated this in the density matrix formalism. I know that you have a Skype meeting. So, because I am already 5 minutes late, I need 3 minutes more. Is it all right or no?
Yeah.
Yes? Okay. So, so now that we have the all results, we can make comparisons. The first comparison is to compare the density matrix with the decay formalin results only for the LV contribution. And what we see is that we have a qualitative agreement or even quantitative, up to some differences which are not really due to the fact that these two formalisms are incompatible. It has to do with the fact that we don't really make the same approximation, but I will not give details. And the other comparison is to compare the LC ARS contribution with the lepton violating contribution. This is shown by this plot, which gives you, well, the first, there are 2 plots. The first plot gives you the full baryon asymmetry with both contributions. And for the baryon asymmetry you get, so any point for the Yukawa couplings here and the mass of the right-handed neutrino here within the dashed line gives you successful leptogenesis, so it's quite open. And this is a plot which compares the full results with only the ARS1. So the blank region is where ARS is dominant, and all other regions, the OR contribution is dominant. So what you see is that we are dominant for small Yukawa couplings, which are the ones we expect in the CISO if there is no cancellation between Yukawa couplings, or for large Yukawa couplings, due to some effect I will not explain, and I think this is the same for another mass splitting. Last thing is that, as I said, the OR contribution is produced just before the Sphaleron decoupling, and the ARS is produced at much higher temperature because there is this MN square over T square difference between both contributions. So if you consider a case where ARS dominates if the reheating temperature you start with is large, when you go to lower reheating temperature, at some point the lepton violating contribution will always dominate. And that's basically all I wanted to say. So thank you.